Shalom, everyone. I'm Josiah Jeffrey.
I'm Hosea Jeffrey.
And we're back discussing the Torah portions. This week, we're discussing the Torah portion, Vayera, which means, and he appeared. The reading this week is from Genesis 18:1 to 22:24. We've already read the portion ahead of time, and so if you would like to read it as well, why don't you go ahead and pause the video right now. You can read it, and then we'll get into discussing.
In Vayera, we see the judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah, as well as the promise reaffirmed for Abraham to have a son through Sarah, named Isaac. Afterwards, Isaac is born. And finally, at the end of this portion, Abraham is called to sacrifice Isaac in a true test of faith.
So this portion starts out with God appearing to Abraham and again reaffirming the promise that he gave at the end of the last portion, which would be that his elderly wife, Sarah, would have a son. And here Adonai appears seemingly as three men, which is kind of odd.
It's very interesting because the form in which Adonai appears to Abraham is as three men here.
Mm-hmm.
And at least at first, Abraham's reaction, it seems like he may not even have realized that it was God.
Possibly. I mean, he gave them food to eat.
Right. He fed them. It reminds me of in Hebrews when he says, "Be not forgetful of showing hospitality to strangers, for through this, unaware, certain ones have entertained messengers."
Yeah.
Here, Adonai appears a little bit later in the portion. They're called messengers.
Right.
So these messengers, or angels, show up at Abraham's house, and his response is to show hospitality. He's like, stay, rest, I'll feed you.
Fine. It's at least by the end of the conversation, he definitely knows that it's God who's there. Because he's like, I am going to go down to Sodom and Gomorrah and judge it and such. And so Abraham does know he's talking to God. And what's really interesting is that here God is appearing in the form of a man, it's kind of confusing. But whatever the case, God is appearing in human form.
Yeah.
This is one of the first times that he does that, if not the first time. I'm not sure, but whenever God appears in the form of a man, it's an interesting foreshadowing of the fact that he will take on human flesh later when Yeshua is born. There was actually an episode of the Biblically Correct podcast a little while ago that covered pre-incarnate Jesus, and it actually talks about this portion, this chapter. So if you want a little bit more commentary on that side of things, you can go check out that video. We aren't going to dive in too deep on that topic right now. But whatever the case, God tells Abraham again that by this time next year, God will visit Sarah and she will have a son. And at this, Sarah, who is preparing the meal, she kind of laughs to herself and she's like, I'm way too old. How on earth am I going to have a son? And God is like, Sarah, did you just laugh? And he's like, I did not laugh. And he's like, you did too laugh.
He didn't say, did you just laugh? He said, why did you laugh?
and he says, nothing is too difficult for Adonai. You are going to have a son. So what I notice is that once again, we see Sarah just kind of doubting the promise. In the last portion, God promises Abraham a son. And then Sarah's like, you need to take my servant girl, Hagar, because I'm too old to have children. Right. And it's like, we talked about, like, she was like trying to force the promise kind of. And when God is more specific, it's like, no, it's going to be Sarah. She laughs at that. And she's like ashamed when God sees her doubt. It's interesting because on the one hand, you have Abraham full of faith, and then you have Sarah who's kind of doubting, you know?
Right. You have Sarah looking at the condition of her own body. And what she sees is causing her to question what she's being told by God.
Right.
Whereas Abraham, when he sees, he doesn't really understand. Abraham laughed too, we were told. But even when he doesn't understand what he sees,
he still believes.
He believes.
Right. And that's what makes Abraham our father by faith, is that he just, no matter what he saw, no matter what he was told, he believed God. And it's a really incredible example that he has.
So after God has made the promise to Abraham and Sarah,
right,
he moves on to go down to Sodom, and Abraham starts to follow. And then God
says, he has like this monologue with himself a little bit.
Like, do I tell Abraham what I'm about to do? He asks himself the question.
Yeah.
It's a little weird. But in his talking to himself, he says an interesting thing about Abraham. He says, I have chosen him, Abraham, that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has promised him. So, I found this really interesting, because in the past he's already been promising, I'm going to make you a great nation.
Right.
In you, all the families of the earth will be blessed.
Yeah.
But in this verse, he's basically saying that that can't happen. He can't bring to Abraham what he's promised until his children after him keep the way of the Lord.
Interesting. Okay.
So, basically, once that chosen nation
is following God, then there'll be a blessing to all the families of the
earth. Right. Then they will finally fulfill the promise to Abraham.
Right.
But they can't fulfill the promise to Abraham just by being.
Right. They have to be walking in the way of Adonai in order to be that blessing, in order to fulfill that call that he gave to Abraham. It's our responsibility as his sons, in a way. It's like God has promised it and he's going to do it. He'll be faithful to do that. But before that can be accomplished, we have to be walking in the way of Adonai.
Exactly.
So after God decides, you know what, I probably should tell Abraham.
Yeah.
he tells Abraham that he's about to go down to Sodom because they are super duper wicked, and he's going down there to check and see if they're really as wicked as he's been hearing, and if necessary, to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, Abraham knows that's where Lot lives. His nephew lives in Sodom, and so Abraham immediately goes into like defense mode and starts trying to negotiate with God. But what if there are righteous people there? Will you destroy it? And he's like, what if there are like 50 people? And God's like, no, I won't destroy it if there are 50 righteous people. What about 40? What about 30? What about 10? And so he like keeps working God down until it's what if there are 10 people? And he's like, I'll spare it if there are 10 people. So this interaction with Abraham and God has always been really interesting to me. And it shows a certain boldness that Abraham has with God. At the same time as he's like, please don't be angry that I'm talking to you about this again each time he does it. But he's like got this boldness to be like, I'm going to reason with God. I'm going to notch him down, trying to do all I can to save Lot, really. And it reminded me, there are a couple of other places in the Tanakh, and it's also referenced in the New Covenant scriptures, Abraham is called a friend of God. Not many people get that title. And it just shows, like, Abraham spoke to God, like, on a level, almost. It starts with God being like, should I tell him? And then he's like, but he's going to be a great nation that I'm calling and stuff. And he's like, so I'm going to tell him. It's like, God even recognizes that Abraham's an important guy, and he keeps Abraham in on the loop. And Abraham's like, well, I got to be involved in this. You know, it's he's acting as an intercessor, really, which kind of foreshadows a little bit the intercessory role of Messiah, where it's like, God has judgment and Yeshua intercedes. It's a really interesting dynamic that you don't see super often, except in the really key figures of Scripture. And it's just another shadow, another pattern that all is pointed at Yeshua.
An interesting thing is God didn't specifically say what it would take to get him to destroy Sodom. He just said, I'm going down there to see how wicked they are. And if they are wicked, I'll know it.
and Abraham is just like, let's quantify this here. Let's figure out how many righteous people there need to be.
Right. But at the same time, it does seem like, you know, God's listening to him.
Mm.
It doesn't explicitly say that God's changing what he's going to do.
Right.
As Abraham says it. Mm. But at the same time, we are told later, God remembered Abraham.
Right.
And saved Lot.
Exactly.
It's because of Abraham's intercession.
That he was like, I'm going to make sure I get Lot out of there.
Right. And we're told in Yaakov, or James, of great power is the prayer of a righteous man.
Mm.
Because Abraham was such a
righteous
righteous man, he had power behind what he said to God.
Yeah.
God took it seriously.
Yeah, you're able to approach God and just say, this is what I want. And you reason it, and it's like you lay it out there.
Right.
And I mean, he's doing it respectfully this whole time.
Oh, yeah.
He's very respectful. He's not like all like, well, you can't destroy Sodom. He's like, but God, wait. I mean, you don't want to be unrighteous, right? Like, but what if there are righteous people?
You know? Right. It's definitely bold, but he's also humble the whole time.
Right.
He's saying, I am but dust and ashes, but I'm here to speak with you.
Right.
Suppose there are some righteous guys in there.
Right. So after God agrees, if there are 10 righteous people, I won't destroy the city, he ends up leaving Abraham. And so now we swipe to Sodom, where two of the men who had left Abraham, now called angels, show up at Lot's door. And they agree to spend the night with Lot. And that night we very vividly see just what kind of wickedness God had been talking about when he was saying that Sodom and Gomorrah were really wicked. All the men of the city come out and they're like, we want to get to know these two new guys. And the whole city, so this is where the name sodomy comes from, is from what the men are doing here. And it shows just how egregious this sin is. And so Lot tries to like reason with this psycho crowd, saying, take my daughters instead, my virgin daughters. And then the whole crowd gets super angry and tries to attack Lot. So it's absolutely crazy what they're doing. It's really unspeakable. And so the angels reach out, grab Lot, and pull him back inside and strike all these evil guys with blindness. And he's like, we need to get out of here now. And Lot actually hesitates, it says. He was like, okay, we need to go. And he talks to his sons-in-law, and they don't believe him. So he ends up having to leave without his sons-in-law. They get destroyed with the rest of Sodom. But Lot himself hesitates to leave. And so the angels have to like literally grab him and forcibly pull him out of there. His wife, after they leave, turns back to look and gets turned to a pillar of salt because they said, don't look. God's destroying this. Don't look back. And then afterwards we'll see Lot's daughters also do some pretty nasty stuff after they get out of there. So it says that God rescued Lot because he remembered Abraham. And as far as we know, Lot was an okay-ish guy, but it really points to what Paul says in 1 Corinthians, where he says that evil associations corrupt good character. Lot had been living among all these evil people, and he and his family were influenced by that. And we saw it with what he tried to offer the crowd, and we saw it with what Lot's daughters ended up doing after the fact. It just, that evil environment did not leave them unaffected. You can't just dwell in the middle of sin and just be like, well, I'll be righteous, I'll be okay.
Kepha says that Lot was worn down by the conduct of the unprincipled people of Sodom.
Right.
And in seeing and hearing what they did, living among them day by day with their wrongful actions, he was tormenting his righteous soul.
Mm.
He was a righteous man.
Right.
But in being there, he was constantly
having that righteousness eroded,
right,
painfully.
Subjecting his soul to attack from evil.
Mm.
Apart from God's rescue, there is no escape from that.
Right.
Sooner or later, all of us, none of us are perfect. Mm. All of us will be worn down by the pressures of society if right. we're not focused on God
mm.
and counting on Him to lead the way out.
Right.
And if we don't look back.
Right. And also not intentionally putting ourselves in situations where we're constantly subjecting ourselves to evil influences. Because those evil influences are just that, influences. They will influence us if we're purposely putting ourselves in those evil situations. If we're purposely ingesting content that's contrary to godly living. If our friends are evil. If the society in general is evil. If we aren't trying to remain pure from that, it will erode our righteousness.
It is interesting, though. It specifically says that the Lord was merciful to Lot when he right. hesitated.
Yeah.
Because
he could have just moved on.
Right. By all rights, he could have been caught in the judgment as well.
Right.
But
because for Abraham's sake, he was merciful to Lot.
Right.
So before moving on from the story of Lot, Sodom and Gomorrah specifically, I just want to point out that Yeshua himself also referenced this story. In Luke 17, he harkens back to both the story of Lot and the story of Noah, which we've already covered, basically saying that they're examples of what it'll be like in the day of the Son of Man. Basically, he says that up until the day of the flood, people were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage, just carrying on as life was normal, and then suddenly the judgment came and swept them away. And God only saved Noah. And in Sodom and Gomorrah, they were being evil and doing all their normal evil things until the day that the destruction swept them away, and he only saved Lot. And Yeshua says that when the judgment comes, you need to not look back. You need to just flee the judgment, not look back. And he says, remember the wife of Lot. What happened to her when she looked back at the evil that she liked back in her past? She got turned to salt. She was dead. She got hit by that wrath, even though she wasn't in the city anymore, because she looked back. So whatever you have doesn't matter. All that matters is fleeing the coming wrath. No earthly possession or past life or desires or anything matter at all. Yeshua says, whoever seeks to obtain his life will lose it, but whoever loses it will preserve it. Don't be like Lot's wife. Don't long for the life which God is destroying.
The sons-in-law were among Sodom.
Mm-hmm.
And Lot came with a report, basically telling them, you need to get out of here if you want to live.
Right.
And because of their disbelief, because they did not believe the report of coming judgment, they didn't follow.
And they got swept away in that judgment.
Right. If you don't believe in the way of escape from the judgment of this world, then you are going to be swept away in that judgment.
Right.
You have to believe, and you have to follow.
Mm.
And you should not hesitate.
Right.
Yeshua says, he on the housetop, let him not come down to take up anything out of his house.
Mm.
And he in the field, let him not turn back to take his coat.
Mm.
The judgment is going to come suddenly and without warning.
Right.
In the midst of all the evil.
Like in the days of Noah, like in the days of Lot.
Right. And when it comes, don't hesitate for anything in the world.
Mm.
Just run. Run to God. And if you run to God, he will save you.
Absolutely. He saved Noah. He saved Lot. He doesn't sweep away the righteous with the wicked. But if you are so hesitant to flee from that wickedness, are you really one of the righteous ones? So after Lot finally escapes from Sodom, he hasn't entirely escaped the wickedness. That wickedness has come along with him, and we see that in the case of his daughters. His daughters see that they're going to have a hard time finding husbands, but they want to carry on Lot's family line. So they have Lot father their children. It's awful. It's very, very wrong. The Torah later overtly condemns this. And they do it by making him drunk. And so it's a whole mess. And it just shows that Lot left his daughters in a horrible place and let them get brainwashed by an evil society. We see that far too often among too many parents these days. If you're allowing your children to be brought up in an evil atmosphere that encourages evil behavior, you shouldn't be surprised when your children start exhibiting evil behavior. And that's what Lot ended up having when he ended up having more children and grandchildren born out of this wickedness.
There are several examples in the Bible of righteous people raising wicked children. Mm. Fatherhood is one of the most difficult things that any righteous person in the Bible can tackle, which is why Moses tells us that the right way to raise your children is to constantly be speaking
the commands when you lie down, when you rise up, when you're walking by the way, when you're sitting down.
Right. You have to make sure that the atmosphere in which you're raising your children
is a godly one.
Right. One in which every day you're teaching them from the Word of God, and you're not letting them be taught out of the world.
Right.
Because the world's always coming up with new ways to be evil.
And just as a very quick side note here, I'll just give you this little fact. The two children who are born to Lot and his daughters are Moab and Ben-Ammi, from which the Moabites and the Ammonites come from. The name Moab, or in Hebrew Moab, means from father. And the word Ben-Ammi means son of my people. So those names themselves kind of reflect where those children came from. It's kind of...
Yeah, it shows that the daughters, it's like they weren't even ashamed of what they did.
Yeah.
They were just like, we preserved the line of our father.
Their minds were so twisted by where they came from. It's pitiful, really.
One other thing I want to point out is that this was all the firstborn's idea. She's driving the whole thing.
Right.
So the younger sister is like caving into peer pressure.
Yeah.
Peer pressure is a big part of that atmosphere that you need to watch out for your kids. It's not just the people who are like
in
superiors.
Charge, right.
The peers
have
aid
huge influence.
Yeah, they have massive influence, and it will often push them toward evil.
Right.
Because, like we've already seen, like we've reiterated, the more people you get together, the more they unite to evil. They unite to evil.
Right.
So, unless there's an active biblical influence to center everyone, peer pressure is generally going to push in an evil direction.
Right.
I do want to add that it specifies. Lot did not know that he did this.
He did not consent to this.
Right. Because Lot was righteous. Like Noah, he got drunk. That's a mistake. But it's not anything like what ended up happening as a result.
Right.
Just like all the other people we're seeing in the Bible, Lot wasn't perfect.
Right.
That's kind of a pattern that we're seeing is all the righteous people in the Bible. God shows mercy and favor to them, and they can even carry a certain weight with him, but they're not perfect. None of them are perfect.
Nobody is perfect. That's starting from Adam and just going forward. You see, no one is perfect. And that's why we all need God's salvation. And God's salvation comes through Yeshua.
So after all this, we finally get back to Abraham.
Yeah.
And so Abraham's gone down to the land of the Philistines, I guess. That's still in the Canaan area. It's still the promised land.
It's still sojourning, it says, but it's... But he's
sojourned in Canaan.
Right, okay.
But anyway, when he gets in there, he says about Sarah again, she's not my wife, she's my sister. So again, the king, whose name is Abimelech, takes Sarah to come and be his wife.
Right.
It's a repeat.
Yeah, it's very, very similar to the last time.
Yeah, very similar. Just like what happened in Egypt. Only in this case, instead of God just striking him with plagues, he basically appears.
He warns Abimelech in a dream.
He says, "What are you doing?" And he's like, "What?"
He's like, "I didn't know anything. He just told me she was his sister. I didn't do anything wrong." And God's like, "Yet, you didn't do anything wrong yet. That's why I'm stopping you. Give him his wife back."
Right.
And even though he had warned Abimelech, it still says that God did bad stuff to them. He had closed the wombs of everybody in his household. Yeah. So once again, he says, "She's my sister." The king gets in trouble for taking Sarah, and then Sarah's given back, and Abraham gets more stuff.
Yeah, Abraham has no consequences. On the contrary, when God appears to Abimelech, he says to him, "Go to Abraham, let him pray for you, and you'll live, because he's a prophet."
Right.
That's a very interesting thing. This is the first time
that Abraham is called a prophet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's very interesting, because like, we don't really see Abraham prophesying exactly.
Not particularly, but God does appear to him and tell him the future. That's right. We see that with lots of prophets. The word of the Lord came to me saying, this is going to happen. And so over and over again, it says, Adonai appeared to Abraham and he gives him information about the future. That's one of the key factors of a prophet.
Yeah. So Abimelech trust God. He's like, "Oh no." He goes to Abraham. And he's like, "Why did you do this to me? Why did you lie to me?" And Abraham says, so his answer is kind of three parts. First, he says, "I was scared that
you would kill me and take my wife."
Right. Because I didn't think you were God-fearing. Which is interesting, because Abimelech clearly is afraid of God.
Yeah. When God shows up, when God shows up in a dream and he's like, "I'm going to kill you," and you get afraid, I mean, that's one thing, as opposed to just in general following God. I mean, they're Philistines.
Right. Yeah. But then the second part of his answer is basically, I didn't technically lie.
She is my half-sister.
Yeah. So like, he somehow, it seems like he's convinced himself this is okay.
Yeah, he's convinced himself it's not a lie. And he says, and the third part of the answer is that I made this like a standing order for Sarah.
Right.
Wherever we go, tell them you're my sister.
Right, yeah. So this is not the second time this has happened. This is probably the second time that...
It caused issues.
Right.
But this was a standing order. If anyone asks, it's like, "Oh, I'm his sister."
Yeah.
It's odd, but... I mean, I do wonder if there was something to it where the peoples that he was visiting were dangerous and he was protecting. But it's the oddest part about this to me is that it's never condemned.
Right.
And it's a half-truth.
That's the weird thing. He's technically not lying, and it's kind of protective. But it's mostly self-protective. It's mostly they will kill me. So, yeah, very strange. But at any rate, like we said before, God's with him, even if he's not perfect.
Yeah.
And so Abimelech's like, "Here's your wife back. In fact, here's sheep. Here's money." Just anything to show I'm innocent. This wasn't my fault.
Right.
And then Abraham prays, and Abimelech's house is given healing.
Right.
So... This is the start of a relationship between Abraham and Abimelech. So jumping forward a little bit, Abimelech and his commander show up to Abraham again and are saying, God is with you in everything you do.
Right.
Please swear an oath that you're going to be kind to us.
Right.
And Abraham swore it. Okay. There's this kind of cordiality between Abraham and Abimelech. And they start to have some scuffles over property and wells and such. Mm-hmm. But the two of them are like, we need to stay nice.
Right.
Again, Abimelech's like, it's not my fault, please. Let's make a covenant.
Yeah.
Which is very interesting. This is the first time we see two people make a covenant.
Right.
In the Bible. And it's a promise of faithfulness. Mm. I'm not taking anything from you. Mm. And you're going to be nice to me and not call God to punish me.
Right. And I think that this really shows what the healthy attitude is toward Abraham and the people of Abraham, which is God is with them. Those who bless you, I will bless, and those who curse you, I will curse. So if you want God to deal favorably with you, you first have to be dealing favorably with Abraham and later Israel. It just kind of shows that that dynamic where it's treat them well, they'll treat you well, and God won't punish you for anything that you do in that regard.
Right. Abimelech had clearly learned the fear of God.
Right.
And with that, when he saw God was with Abraham, came almost the fear of Abraham. But he didn't really have anything to fear as long as he was being kind to Abraham.
Right.
It's very interesting. As far as I know, Abimelech's the only Philistine that was ever kind to the people of Israel.
So at the beginning of chapter 21, we learn that Adonai took note of Sarah, and he did what he promised to give her a son. So she conceived and gave birth to a son named Isaac. The name Isaac, or in Hebrew Yitzchak, means laughter. So as we saw when God first promised a son to Abraham through Sarah in the previous portion, Abraham laughs. And then when he says it in front of Sarah, Sarah laughs. Right. And then when she gives birth to a son, she says, anyone who hears about a woman as old as me giving birth, they'll laugh with me. And when God first promised that Sarah would give birth to a son, he said to call Sarah's son Isaac. And so here we see the son of the promise is named Isaac, and she gives birth to him, nurses him, and he's weaned. And then we learn that Ishmael, Abraham's firstborn son through Hagar, begins to mock Isaac. So the child that's not the son of the promise is mocking the son who is of the promise. So Sarah is naturally upset, like she was upset when Hagar was mistreating her. So the same mistreatment that Hagar showed to Sarah, Ishmael is showing to Isaac. And so Sarah says, you need to send Hagar and Ishmael away. And Abraham doesn't want to do that. That's his son. But God says, no, Sarah's right. Isaac is the son of the promise. You need to send Ishmael away.
But yeah, it's definitely interesting. Last portion, we talked about how Sarah's choice to give Hagar to Abraham resulted in strife. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of just continuing.
Right.
And this is the final end of that. Mm. This is God saying, it's time to put an end to this.
They need to separate.
Right. He already said he was going to make Ishmael a nation. Mm-hmm. And he confirms it again to Abraham. He's saying, don't be upset. Mm-hmm. Ishmael is going to become a nation. Right. And we see, after Abraham sends Hagar and Ishmael away,
he doesn't forget them.
No, he provides for them.
Right.
He's basically watching over them, and making sure Ishmael survives.
It's because Ishmael is Abraham's son. It says that in verse 13, I will make a nation from Ishmael also because he is your descendant. So this story of Ishmael and Isaac, where Isaac is the son of the promise and Ishmael gets sent away, Paul actually refers back to that story in Galatians chapter 4, using it as an allegory. So he's not saying like this is something explicit, like a one-to-one thing. He's saying it's an allegory. And he says that the allegory is the son of the slave woman, Hagar, so Ishmael, can be allegorized to be the covenant made at Sinai, which would be the covenant of the Torah given by Moses. And Isaac, the son of the promise, can be allegorized to be the heavenly Jerusalem. So Ishmael represents the first covenant and today's Jerusalem. And Isaac represents the new covenant and heavenly Jerusalem. It's a little bit confusing, but essentially what he says is that as believers, we are sons of the promise. If we're trying to be righteous simply by keeping all the commands of Torah, if we're trying to be under the guardianship of Torah, then we're essentially slaves. We're slaves to that trying to make ourselves righteous, and it doesn't work. And so even if we're Jews and we're children by flesh of Abraham, that doesn't mean that we're children of the promise that will be a blessing to all the families of the earth in that way. We aren't walking in that promise. And so that's not enough to be part of the new covenant. To be part of the new covenant, to be a child of the promise, you have to be walking in that new covenant, and you won't be a slave to being righteous on your own strength through the guardianship of Torah.
Like we already covered, in order for the people of Israel to fulfill their calling as a blessing, they have to follow the way of Adonai in righteousness and justice. And that's really impossible to do without following in the faith of Abraham. It's by that faith that we can walk in the promise. Like Abraham was walking in faith of the promise.
Right.
And that's why he had a son, Isaac. So if we follow in those steps, then we are like Isaac.
We're like Isaac in that we're children of the promise.
Right. And as such, we are free. And we have the inheritance. Ishmael had an inheritance, kind of, in that he got to be a nation, but
he didn't get the inheritance that was promised to Abraham and his descendants, which was the land of Canaan, and the promise that there'll be a blessing to all the families of the earth. That didn't go to Ishmael.
Right. He became great nations, but they ended.
Yeah, they were just nations.
Just like one day, the Jerusalem that is going to end with the whole earth.
Right.
But the Jerusalem above, it's forever. And it's ours to inherit if we walk as children of the promise.
Right.
So after this, God speaks to Abraham to test him. And he says, Abraham, take your son, your only son, Isaac, and offer him as a burnt offering. Whoa. Yeah. So the first thing that I want to note is that he calls him his only son.
Right.
Which is interesting because he had Ishmael, but he's just sent him away.
Right,
so
exactly.
Really, this couldn't have happened the way it happened until Ishmael was gone.
Right.
Because even before Isaac was born, Abraham kept putting some hope in Ishmael.
Right.
Like, what's Ishmael going to be? Is Ishmael going to be my son of the promise? Even after God was like, no. He's like, but can't Ishmael live before you?
Right.
But now Ishmael's out of the picture. And now he's got one son.
One heir.
Yeah, this is your heir. This is your hope. Without him, you'll never be a nation. And he says, sacrifice him to me. I can imagine that you wouldn't want to do that to your son.
Especially since it doesn't just say your only son. It says, take your son, your only son, whom you love.
Yeah.
Of course, Abraham loved Isaac, but this was his only son left. And he's the son of the promise. And he's the son of his first wife, Sarah. He's the miracle child that he's been waiting for 100 years for. And God says, kill him and burn him to a crisp.
But ever faithful, Abraham proceeds to comply. Mm. We're told in Hebrews some of Abraham's thought process. Mm. He had such faith that he believed that God could raise Isaac out of the dead.
Right.
So that was what he had in mind when he was going. He was like, I'm just got to do what God says.
God will work it all out in the end. I just got to do what he says.
Because what God is saying this, he's also made the promise. Abraham knows that Isaac is going to be a nation.
Right.
So he's like, even if I kill Isaac, he'll still be a nation. Because that's what God right. said.
It's the ultimate trust. No matter what God is telling me to do, no matter what I'm seeing, God told me what's going to happen, and I know what's going to happen. It's amazing.
I mean, on the other hand, in addition to the fact that he's going to lose his son if he does this, there is the weirdness of
human sacrifice.
Right. God's asking Abraham to do a human sacrifice, and we know God's testing him.
Right.
God doesn't actually end up letting Abraham go through with it, which we'll see. But Abraham is willing to comply, even with something that seems despicable.
Right.
Which God himself says is despicable later.
Later in the
Torah, he hasn't said it yet.
Right.
But
you kind of know.
Right.
And especially since he has said, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man will his blood be shed.
Right.
Abraham is putting his own life on the line, essentially. I mean, he doesn't care what the consequences are. He just knows, God told me to do this, so I have to do it.
He's not looking for a loophole around the plain command of God.
Right.
He knows what God wants him to do. Even if it seems like it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Like it's wrong even. Mm. But God isn't wrong.
It doesn't matter.
He knows that God is never wrong. He already said, shall not the judge of the earth do what is just? Mm. So he knows whatever God wants him to do, that's just. Mm. And so he proceeds to go forward with it.
Right.
Now, the reality is, God was never actually going to let him do it.
Right.
But Abraham didn't know that.
That was the whole point. It was a test. It was, what is the most ridiculous, horrible, out of your mind thing that I could tell Abraham to do right now? I'm going to tell him to do that and see if he trusts me.
Right.
This is the ultimate trust exercise.
And so, passing the test, he takes Isaac with him, goes to the land that God says to go to do it, goes up on the mountain, builds the altar, gets everything ready. He even binds Isaac and puts him on the altar and takes the knife in his hand. And he raises it up. Mm.
And God's like, Abraham, no, don't do it.
God says, now I know that you have the faith.
Right.
You passed the test. You did not withhold your son from me.
Right.
That's the important thing here, is that Abraham was willing to give up everything he had for God, including his own son.
Absolutely.
Yeshua says, whoever loves his father or mother or brothers or sister above me is not able to be my disciple.
He didn't love his son above God. Right. He loved Isaac. It says that. He loved Isaac, but he loved God more and he trusted God more. On the way up the mountain, before he actually goes through with it, Isaac was kind of confused because he's like, we're doing a burnt offering. I don't see an animal for it. And Abraham says a really, really key phrase. He says, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. Now, earlier in this parasha, we already saw that Abraham is called a prophet. What he says turns out to be prophetic, because after God stops Abraham from going through with it, he looks and there is a ram stuck in the bushes. And it says that Abraham killed the ram instead of his son Isaac. So this whole story is rich with messianic allusions. So first off, we have the loving father who is giving his one and only son whom he loves as a sacrifice. So right there we have that, and we know that the father gave his one and only son. That's what God did for us when he gave Yeshua. So right there we have Abraham kind of as a picture of God, and in that sense, Isaac is kind of a picture of Yeshua. But probably more vividly is that ram that died in place of Isaac. When God issued that command to Abraham, kill your son, Isaac, Isaac's life was owed. A death was owed. And that innocent ram died in Isaac's place. It says that he died in Isaac's place. So that ram is an excellent picture of the substitutionary nature of Yeshua's sacrifice. Our life is owed, and Yeshua died in our place. God provided a lamb, the Lamb of God, Yeshua. And Yeshua himself kind of hints at the fact that Abraham might have known a little bit more, because he says that Abraham rejoiced that he would see my day. Yeshua says that. He says, Abraham rejoiced that he would see my day. He saw it and was glad. So Abraham looked forward and he saw Yeshua. And it doesn't explicitly say what event caused him to see Yeshua, but considering how vividly this pictures Yeshua, the lamb died on behalf of someone else.
Yeah, and Abraham knew that it was going to happen because he saw ahead to the Lamb of God, who's taking away the sin of the world.
Right.
But once Abraham has passed the test, we see some more messianic prophecy along with some more promise.
Right.
God calls to Abraham, and he says, by myself I have sworn, declares Adonai. So that's really big deal. He's swearing by himself.
Yeah. Is Hebrews the one that talks about? Yeah.
Yeah. Hebrews talks about how when people want to show the gravity of something they're swearing, they swear by God because God's greater than them.
Right.
God had no one greater to swear by. There was nothing greater he could have sworn by than himself, which just shows that he could not make this oath any more emphatic.
Right. He's like, by myself I have sworn. He's like, my name is on the line here.
Yeah. Tying himself to the promise, to the people of the promise. And he says, by myself I have sworn, I will bless you, I will multiply your offspring, and your seed shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in your seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. So obviously, this is talking about Isaac and the people who come from Isaac,
Israel.
The people of Israel.
Right.
But at the same time, there's more to this. Because, like we already said, in a sense, in this event, Isaac is prophesying Yeshua.
Isaac is the only son of the father.
Right. And so also in this promise, when he speaks about the seed in whom all the nations of the earth will be blessed, he's not just talking about Isaac. Paul explains that he's also talking about Yeshua.
He says that he uses the word seed. He doesn't say seeds. And the seed, talking about one, is Yeshua. It's a dual fulfillment prophecy because it's the people of Israel that will take the blessing to all the families of the earth. But that blessing comes through Yeshua. We cannot bless the nations of the earth without Yeshua. And Yeshua is the seed of Abraham. He's a Jew. And so in that, He brought salvation from sin and redemption to all mankind. He was the seed of Abraham, and he did that. He has brought blessing to all the families of the earth. And the dual fulfillment will be when the Jewish people bring that blessing of Yeshua to the Gentiles, to all the nations. And there's life out of the dead, as Paul says in Romans 11.
Right. And this promise is interesting. It has a unique aspect that we've never heard in any of the other promises. And it's almost like it's introducing the concept of the Messiah's triumph and deliverance of his people. When he says, "And your seed shall possess the gate of his enemies."
Mm.
This is a concept that's not talked about a whole lot in the Torah, but in the prophets it's talked about a lot.
Right.
The concept, and it just confirms that it's talking about the seed Messiah.
Right.
When it's saying that he will defeat the enemies of his people.
Right.
And that's part of how he'll be a blessing, is when he comes and he brings that redemption and triumph for his people.
In that it's a dual prophecy, there's also dual layers to that dual prophecy, because Yeshua came the first time as a sacrifice for sins, and he'll be coming again to salvation. I believe it says that in Hebrews.
Yeah.
Part of this is, so this prophecy has been partially fulfilled, and parts of it haven't been fulfilled yet. It's a very deep prophecy, and it points to Yeshua, and it points to the people of Israel, because the Israelites also defeated plenty of their enemies, especially in the conquest of the land. And yet, as we see today, Israel still has so many enemies. We have so many enemies, and they're attacking us all the time. They've been attacking us for 4,000 years. But one day, the seed of Abraham will possess the gate of his enemies, and he will bring a blessing to all the nations of the earth.
So I would say, big takeaway, you have to follow God. You want to be righteous, you have to follow God. And that means not only leaving behind everything you have, not waiting, but also giving up everything you have, fleeing wickedness, leaving it all behind. Don't look back, and look forward to God with the kind of faith that will let you give up the things that you value most in life, because you shouldn't value anything more.
Even the good things.
Even the good things. Because you shouldn't value anything more than God.
That wraps up the portion of Vayera. Next week we'll be reading the portion Chaye Sara, so be sure to join us for that. Thanks so much for watching this video. Be sure to like, share, comment, subscribe, and hit that notification bell to keep updated on new episodes. And if you would, please consider sending us a donation to help us make more videos like these. Thanks so much for watching, and we'll see you next week. God bless.